This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents I Wrote This Book Because I Love You. Essays by Tim Kreider. Read by the author.
For my sisters, adoptive, half, and chosen. One of the greatest gifts you can give anybody is the gift of your honest self. Fred or Mr. Rogers. Whatever is done out of love always occurs beyond good and evil. Friedrich Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil. Dramatis personae. Tim, our narrator. Annie, an invalid. Zack, her scorned betrothed. Lou, a clown. Zoe, a harlot. Harold, a rascal. Mishka, a rogue. Lauren, an artist. Lars, her husband. George, a fool. Katie Jo, a libertine. Lucy, friend and counselor. TJ, a polyamorist. Kevin, a faithless husband. The Quetzal, a cat. Margot, a journalist. Sylvia Bell, a learned doctor. Rosalind, a youth. Gina, an actress. Diana, a clergywoman. Friedrich, a philosopher. Circus troupe with animals. And assorted students and bohemians. Scene. In America, with an excursion to Mexico. A note on veracity. Although I am scrupulous about sticking to the truth, to the best of my recall, and I'm just bad at making things up, this isn't to say that other people featured as characters in these essays wouldn't have different, sometimes conflicting recollections. But almost all of them have read the essays in which they appear, and, more or less graciously, given their approval. I have in a few cases elided or altered details in order to disguise people's identities. And I've changed everybody's names, except for those of public figures like Nietzsche and George. As always, I had to keep all the best stuff out. Death-defying acts. Say, I think if we got married, you could ride the circus train to Mexico with me for free, Annie wrote in a P.S. to a postcard to me in 1998. Think about it. The card's front bore a Richard Avedon portrait of William S. Burroughs, whose shriveled visage will always be associated in my memory with my first proposal of marriage. Annie had run off to join the circus after breaking up with her last boyfriend, who was, among other things, a unicyclist and a juggler. I'd driven the getaway car when she'd left all of his belongings and everything he'd ever given her on his porch, with a melodramatically worded note placed atop the pile. She'd answered a cryptic classified ad for a teaching position in the Miami Herald, gone in for an interview, and unexpectedly found herself working for the famous Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus, living on a train with roustabouts, clowns, and hippopotami. She was actually employed by the same agency that provides teachers to child actors on movie sets. By law, all U.S. children have to have 180 days of schooling a year, whether they're starring in a Spy Kids sequel or being publicly flung from one parent to another 50 feet above the ground. And Annie's job was to ensure that the children of aerialists got the same education as their earthbound peers. She had complained to me that education wasn't especially valued at the circus. The general attitude seemed to be, "What do you need with some diploma? You'll always have the trapeze." But she loved her life on board the train, riding the rails from city to city, setting up her portable one-room classroom in the dingy innards of downtown arenas. I'd visited her at the Baltimore Civic Center when the circus had come to town, where, to get to her classroom, I'd had to sidle between tigers sacked out in their cages like half-ton house cats. It provided her ideal living situation, she explained, constant change within a framework of structure. Annie had always liked road trips, sleeper cars, hotels, and room service. Her childhood heroine had been Eloise, the little girl who lived in the plaza. I took her proposal less seriously than you might think, and not only because it came in a P.S. I knew a number of people who had believed themselves at various times to be engaged to Annie. She was famously once engaged to two men at the same time. Our friend Zach, who had a history of moving across the country to begin his new life with Annie, only to find himself dumped on arrival, and poor, poor Ted, a very sad avant-garde composer. Annie downplays that whole episode as a miscommunication or slight overlap in timing. Zach is philosophical about it now. Annie was more excitable in those days, he sighs. She and I had nearly gotten married once, too, in the Mall of America's wedding chapel, but this was more in the nature of a caper. And in any case, we were foiled by the state's buzzkill 24-hour waiting period. Annie and I knew each other and ourselves too well to delude ourselves that we would do anything other than drive each other insane if we were ever to attempt to date. We were like each other's evil twins. We were both adopted, both had mitral valve prolapse. Our younger sisters were both named Laurie, and our fathers had both died of cancer when we were in college. Our relationship was partly predicated on unrepentant selfishness. The tacit shtick between us was that neither of us really cared about anyone but ourselves, so around each other, we could quit faking and relax. I'd once watched with interest as a New York City con artist had tried to exploit Annie's sympathy and guilt. It was as though he were dealing three-card Monty for the blind. The only thing that reliably made her weep was the poignant theme from the old Incredible Hulk TV show. I'd also been Annie's traveling companion before and knew to be wary of hidden agendas. On a cross-country trip a few years earlier, the same one that began with our leaving the pile of possessions on her ex's doorstep, we detoured a whole day's drive up into the Idaho panhandle before she revealed, over beers, that we were there to perpetrate another caper. I was to photograph her gloating in front of her ex's summer cabin, where he had never once taken her, which photo she would then send to him. So I was unsurprised to learn that the real reason she wanted me to travel to Mexico and to marry her was for protection. She'd been hearing about how dangerous Mexico City was and been told that, as a single woman, she could expect to be ceaselessly harassed. So she thought she might be safer with a husband along to escort her. I was not anyone's first choice for a bodyguard. In fact, I had a history of being assaulted abroad. But I was well known to be unemployed and always game for a caper. Annie was either more acutely conscious of her mortality or less able to deal with it than anyone else I've ever known. She feared it in the same visceral way that other people are terrified of spiders or heights. One night in college, when she was having one of her panic attacks about death, she flipped frantically through the TV channels, trying to find something to distract her, and she happened across a Ginger Rogers Fred Astaire movie called Carefree. Annie was entranced. The film did exactly as advertised, made her forget herself for a couple of hours in a lighthearted dream of elegance and grace. Human beings never were more lovely, more perfect in motion. Annie is not a halfway kind of girl, and for the next several years she became obsessed with Ginger Rogers. She talked incessantly about Ginger Rogers, amassed as complete a collection of Ginger Rogers movies as could be found on VHS, and made a pilgrimage to Ginger Rogers Ranch in Oregon, which was not open to the public. A very polite personal assistant gave her a tour of the grounds and an autographed photo before shooing her off. Ginger Rogerism was a perfectly serviceable religion. Annie did not try to convert unbelievers or burn heretics alive. She'd found solace in a harmless fantasy of athletic perfection and deathless beauty in frivolous spectacle. But in this case, Annie wasn't just being paranoid. The Mexican economy had collapsed in 1994, and over the next 3 years, crime in Mexico City increased by nearly 60%. By 1997, there were an average of 3 murders, 94 assaults on pedestrians, 78 assaults on drivers, and 25 home invasions per day. For a while, there was no nightlife in the city. Bars, restaurants, theaters, and clubs all shut down at dusk because no one would venture out after dark. In 1998, when Annie invited me to go, the U.S. State Department reported that violence, quote, had reached critical levels. The official State Department warnings on Mexico, which took some time to print out, cited recent incidents of Americans being murdered kidnapped, raped in taxis, drugged in bars, and accidentally slammed into the sides of hotels while parasailing. They made it sound like open season on gringos down there. Annie told me everyone at the circus had been studying this same printout. I figured people who walked on the high wire and got into cages with wild animals nightly probably had more accurate risk assessment skills than civilians. So I asked her, "So do people at the circus seem worried, or everyone's petrified?" Although I didn't suffer from the same sort of acute thanatophobia as Annie, I'd always been uncomfortably conscious of what Francis Bacon, the painter, not the philosopher, called the potential disaster that stalks us every day, even before I got stabbed in Crete. The morbid imagination we shared had always been another bond between us. I'd once reduced her to weeping with glee by delivering a mock funeral oration for her. But in the end, it wasn't her deviousness or even her perversity that made her so ornery. It was the malice of the woman. And Mexico offered no shortage of material for the morbid imagination. The Dangers and Annoyances section of the guidebook I consulted ran to several pages, covering annoyances from cholera to volcanic activity. I was advised by friends that I would inevitably contract dysentery from the food, and told, quote, "Your mucus will turn black from the air pollution, the worst in the hemisphere." So I was, understandably, a little skittish. Nevertheless, my policy has always been, whenever someone proposes I marry them and ride the circus train with them to Mexico City, to say yes. And Annie's postcard had found me convalescing on my sofa in the aftermath of a romantic imbroglio known to history as Armageddon 97. So I was in need of a distraction, an adventure, something to get a man up off his couch and moving again. It was one of those situations in which you get to pretend you're coming to someone's rescue when secretly they're coming to yours. Although I was not required to legally marry Annie, I would at least have to pose as her husband, since only spouses were allowed to ride the train, not boyfriends or other freeloaders. The plan was that I would meet the circus train in Roanoke, Virginia, and we would ride it together for 3 days down to the Mexican border. The train no longer traveled all the way to Mexico City, because back when it had, they'd had to erect a fence around it and post guards to protect it against thieves. Now everyone disembarked in San Antonio and flew the rest of the way down, while a shorter section of the train, carrying the animals and equipment, continued on to Mexico City. Annie and I, in deference to her flying phobia, which she always emphasized was not a fear of heights or falling or incineration, but of loss of control, would be taking the bus, a 20-hour journey. In Roanoke, I found Annie in road trip mode, her long red hair braided into two Pippi Longstocking pigtails, wearing denim overalls over a striped shirt which left small triangles of pale midriff exposed on either side that were very hard not to poke. One of the first things she did after I arrived was to make me feel a lump on her back. She had mentioned this lump several times on the phone. She was certain it was a tumor. Annie had suffered from a case of hypochondria for years, which had been triumphantly vindicated the year before when she'd been diagnosed with lupus, the disease that killed Flannery O'Connor. Back in O'Connor's day, it was generally assumed that if you had lupus, you were going to die young. This was no longer necessarily true by the 1990s, but it was still incurable and had, quote, a significant morbidity rate. Survival rates decreased steadily over time, so that although Annie was 90% likely to be alive 5 years from now, in 2003, she was less than 70% likely to make it to the year 2018. Her doctor had strongly recommended that Annie stop researching her illness on internet message boards. You'd think that controlling a chronic disease would provide an outlet for her hypochondria and obsessive tendencies, but by now Annie wasn't making a big deal of lupus anymore. She had to take antimalarials and aspirin for inflammation after eating, and periodically had blood drawn to monitor her antibody levels. The condition was also a convenient excuse to avoid the sun and the outdoors, both of which Annie had always hated. Whenever anyone learning about her diagnosis asked, "Is there anything I can do for you?" she always answered, "You could give me $50. My ex-girlfriend Margot had sent her a check, along with a note. "Dear Annie, I am very sorry you have lupus. Here are $50 for you." She still found the energy to worry about other unrelated anomalies, such as the suspect lump. She pulled up the back of her shirt, felt around for it with her arm twisted up between her shoulder blades, and pressed my fingers into it. The lump was about the size of a junior mint and jiggled slightly under pressure. My own diagnosis was that it was one of those weird things that just appears for no reason and would probably go away on its own. Her doctor had told her it was, quote, adipose tissue, which I knew very well meant it was a fat lump. Annie preferred to refer to it as adipose tissue and continued to monitor it closely, regarding it as pre-malignant at best. My first night on board, Annie took me on a tour of the train. The hallways weren't quite wide enough for two people to pass, so if you saw someone coming, you'd politely race to step aside in the bathroom alcove in the center of the car. Some of the doors were personalized with signs or stickers. Still pissed at Yoko. Or had homey little welcome mats laid out front. Each car had its own distinct smell, like each of your childhood friends' houses, ranging from antiseptic to uric to sweet and sour pork. Annie told me this was the longest privately owned train in the world, over a mile from engine to caboose with 32 coaches, not counting flat cars and animal cars. Highlights of our tour would include the clown car, the ghetto car, and the pie car. "Did you say the ghetto car?" I asked. "You'll see," she told me. The circus train constituted a stark microcosmic class hierarchy, wherein space equaled status. The stars of the show, the chief clown and the tiger tamer, each had an entire car for their families. The rank-and-file clowns got rooms the size of wardrobes, about 3 by 6 feet. Annie's room was respectably spacious, though still tiny by normal standards. What Annie liked best about it was that she didn't have to get out of bed to get anything. The mini-fridge, hot plate, sink, closet, tape player, VCR, and TV remote were all within reach. Any loose items secured with bungee cords. She warned me that the train would jolt violently at night. It was an ideal room for an aspiring invalid. Because their rooms were so cramped, the clowns tended to leave their doors open and congregate in the hall. They called it a dorm on wheels. When we passed through the clown car, the clowns were all hanging out in the kitchen, making dinner and listening to a Michael Jackson tape. They were essentially theater kids, attention getters and cut-ups. So someone was always singing, juggling, playing outdoor sports indoors, or wanging someone else over the head with a cookie sheet. There was a mosaic of photos on the wall, in which, on a cursory inspection, I found two pictures of naked people in clown makeup. Only the faces were painted. Annie paused to brief me outside the door marked generator car, in which it would be too loud for us to talk. "The ghetto car is on the other side of this car," she said. "We'll have to blow through pretty fast, so it doesn't look like we're there to gawk. Also," she admitted, "it kind of scares me in there." Then she opened the door to a clattering din, and we clamped our hands over our ears and ran. When I had to unclamp one hand to open the door at the other end of the car, the noise physically hurt. As we walked nonchalantly but quickly through the ghetto car, I saw that people in there didn't even get rooms, just sleeping berths with curtains, like sailors' hammocks below decks. Once we were through, Annie explained that the circus would pick up itinerant workers, what civilians would call the homeless, keep them aboard for as long as they needed the extra hands, and then kick them off wherever they happened to be when they didn't require them anymore. "They're basically hobos," she said. Pie car is circus slang for the dining car. There is no pie there. It smelled like greasy frying breakfast, brewing coffee, and cigarette smoke. The curtains were patterned with a row of pig's butts lined up at a trough. A VCR was showing one of the two movies continuously running on the train's closed-circuit system. Eavesdropping in the pie car was one of the only ways I had of getting any inside information about life in the circus. Because they've long been regarded as vagrants and pariahs, circus folk are an insular society. You're either with the circus or you're not. And being with the circus means for life. Careers are hereditary, acts dynastic. A lot of performers come from old circus families in Eastern Europe. Annie, who'd been here the better part of a year, was still viewed as a transient and an outsider. But in the pie car, I could eat a belly buster, which was a cheeseburger with bacon and a fried egg on top, and listen in on the roustabouts bitching about the boredom, the overtime, and the animal rights workers who demonstrated at every arena. Yeah, like they're not wearing leather shoes. I got to hear the cotton candy man say, "When I finish making that candy, man, I'm done." "Enough of this excitement," one guy announced on my first morning, putting out a cigarette in his plate. "Time for beer." "You'll see plenty of drinking here," Annie was warned when she joined the circus. "All times of day." Annie and I liked to drink beers in the vestibule between her car and the next, which had a Dutch door we could open to the air. We'd sit dangling our legs over the side and occasionally poke our heads out into the wind and noise. If you stuck your hand out there when a tree branch was whipping past, the leaves would smack your palm hard enough to sting for minutes. Lights flashed and clanging bells dopplered by as we passed through intersections. As the train traveled farther south, the metal swing sets, piles of tires, and misty hills of Appalachia gave way to groves of bamboo and honeysuckle, fields plowed in undulating green and yellow lines like contour maps. We saw a woman standing in her lawn in her house dress, a pit filled with cattle bones. A repairman bent over, exposing what looked like 2 feet of ass crack. Once, when we had stopped for a minute, I leapt down off the train and quick grabbed us some honeysuckle to taste, while Annie went, "Aye!" and flapped her hands in delighted alarm. As we sat drinking beers and watching the passing countryside, we'd spin elaborate worst-case scenarios. I would survive Mexico City, but ironically die in a plane crash on the way home. Annie would avoid flying, but be ironically killed in a bus wreck. My plane would crash ironically into her bus. We imagined both of us peering out the train door and getting our heads neatly squawked off by a passing train or telephone pole, and our lifeless torsos, now open fire hydrants of blood, toppling back into the vestibule. Annie has very loose, jiggly kneecaps that were fun to slither around under her skin while we talked. "You know the train master will throw you off the train if he catches you doing that," someone passing through the vestibule told us. He meant dangling our legs out of the train. Annie told me he probably wasn't exaggerating. The circus's management philosophy was very 19th century. The basic contract was, "You don't like it? Get off the train." So we stood instead, leaning over the closed lower door to look outside. When we were on a bend in the track, the wheels screeching against the rails, you could see nothing but train curving away in either direction, people leaning out the windows and doors to wave and give each other the finger. For the first time, I could appreciate the train's true length. It was like being inside the Empire State Building laid on its side. Big red circus letters painted on the sides of the cars advertised who we were. No one can resist waving to the circus train. One group even waved to us from a cemetery. We had no choice but to wave back, conscripted into service as ambassadors of goodwill. Sometimes Annie wore a red clown nose while waving. At one crossing, a man sitting in the cab of his pickup waiting for the train to pass got to see Annie, wearing the nose, flash her breasts at him. I caught a glimpse of his face bursting into laughter before he was whisked into the past. We were hanging out in the vestibule when one of the concessionaires approached us and mumbled, "Now, I don't mean nothing funny," a sure sign of impending funniness, "but I never knew the teacher was married. Some of the things I said, I shouldn't have said them." It seemed he was trying to apologize for having flirted with Annie, apparently so clumsily she'd failed to notice. She told him it was fine, but she didn't like knowing that people were talking about us. She was still seething over having been teased in print for being standoffish by Big Bertha, the circus newsletter's anonymous gossip columnist. Even more than most workplaces, the circus was a hotbed of gossip. After all, everyone not only worked together but lived together. It was effectively a small town. One of the dancers later asked me whether Annie and I were really married, boyfriend-girlfriend, just friends, or what. "Just friends," I answered, after a telltale hesitation. "Liar," she said. I mean, it's true we were having sex, but this was more in the spirit of two people who happened to have a common enthusiasm for an extremely fun activity, the same way two guys who both enjoy drinking or chess might say, "It's 5 o'clock somewhere," or "How about a quick game?" Once when we were hanging out in the vestibule, the train hit an especially rough stretch of track, and one of us idly wondered what it would be like to try to have sex during this severe rhythmic jouncing. We exchanged a look. An instant later, we had vamoosed, leaving a cartoon Annie and me-shaped puff of dust where we'd been standing. After we disembarked in San Antonio, Annie made it a mission to buy wedding rings before crossing the border as a prophylactic against harassment. We got a pair of fake gold bands from a street vendor for $5 apiece. It was funny. Even though I never noticed whether anyone else is wearing a wedding ring, I immediately felt as if mine were radiating my bogus marital status to everyone in sight. It seemed as if we ought to have some sort of ceremony. As we put them on, I said to Annie, "Now we are man and wife." "Man," she snickered. On the eve of our departure for Mexico, We went to see a movie about an asteroid destroying all life on Earth, and wept at the scene of the doomed astronauts saying farewell to their loved ones back home. Annie called her mother that night. The next day, at the bus station, we agonized over whether to take the 1:30 or the 2:30 to Mexico City, since there was no way of knowing in advance which of them was destined to crash, decapitating all on board. I got all calm and fatalistic and told Annie it was out of our hands. We'd just have to choose blindly. At the border, Annie took longer than everyone else going through the custom house because she had to obtain a work visa. I was on the bus waiting for her when the driver stood up and asked us all something in Spanish. I realized he was trying to confirm that everyone was back on board, and I stood up and used my first public Spanish. No! I know it's the same word as in English, but I yelled it with a Spanish accent. Everyone turned to look at me. Mi esposa, I explained, gesturing helplessly toward the customs building. Everyone smiled, understanding. It was the only word I could think of. The economic escarpment at the border was dramatic. The asphalt and neon of Backstreet America turned abruptly to dirt roads, hand-lettered signs, kids piled into the backs of pickup trucks, and livestock just standing in the middle of the street. For a couple of hundred miles, we saw nothing but prickly pear and Joshua trees, with an occasional line of jagged peaks on the horizon. We used our time on the bus to attempt to hastily learn Spanish and jot down some wills. Looking for safety instructions, I stuck my hand in the pocket on the back of the seat in front of me, into what proved to be a gooey orange burrito stuffed with hair. It seemed an ill omen. Annie had been somewhat reassured of our odds after phoning her mother, who told her that all her old lady friends had been going to Mexico City for years and none of them had ever been kidnapped or killed. The State Department's been issuing those same warnings for 20 years, she said. Of course, my mom dismissed my lupus symptoms for a year before I was diagnosed, said Annie. You know what she said to me when I told her I had it? Well, dear, everybody's got to have something. Danger is almost always less than you imagine it to be, our hotel's guidebook assured us. The hotel where most of the circus workers were being put up was on a heavy-flow 8-lane street across from a Walmart. On the afternoon we arrived, there was a windstorm that blotted out the view with dense gusts of dust and grit and garbage, airborne because the city had been completely denuded of grass. It was like the weather on Mars. I asked one of the clowns, who is originally from Mexico City, whether the sky was ever blue here. Yes, he said. Really? I don't know, he admitted. The hotel guidebook also mentioned, as a point of local color, that the nearby Hill of the Star had in pre-Columbian times been the site of the new fire ceremony, in which, once every 52 years, a sacrificial victim's heart would be carved out and a fire lit in his chest cavity. It was sort of like Groundhog Day. If the fire continued to burn, runners would light torches from it and take them to temples throughout the empire to let people know that the world would continue to exist. The book did not say what happened if the fire went out. As a footnote, further research has determined that what would happen was that skeleton women, with eyes and teeth all over their bodies, would descend from the stars and kill everyone in the world with knives and devour their flesh. Over dinner in the hotel restaurant that night, I reassured Annie that I wouldn't blame her, in my last moments, if I were to be killed here. No, she said, I'd blame myself. I appreciate that, I said, but I wouldn't want you to feel bad about it for the rest of your life. How long? Well, you should always feel a little bad about it, but don't let it ruin your life. I'll never forgive myself, she said solemnly. I noticed she was talking about it in the future tense now instead of the good old conditional. The main thing to remember, I said, is that I liked you a lot and you made the last year of my life much better. Aw, said Annie, sounding genuinely touched for once. You really sound like you're going to die. This sort of paranoia was rampant throughout the circus. In the hotel lobby, I had noticed one of the musicians reading a book titled The Most Dangerous Places in the World. On the shuttle bus, a dancer said, I thought Baltimore was scary. Annie overheard the tiger tamer talking to his wife long distance on a payphone, complaining about being afraid of the food, eating nothing but steak day after day. By way of a sign-off, he said, I'll try not to die. On our first full day in Mexico City, the entire circus was assembled in the arena for a briefing by a representative of the American Embassy. He wearily reiterated the State Department warnings that we'd all by now memorized, the spiked drinks, the ATM robberies, the death trap taxis. A worst-case scenario, he said, would involve being kidnapped for anywhere from 12 to 72 hours, driven around the city, and forced to withdraw money from ATMs at gunpoint. Crime in Mexico City is virtually a risk-free proposition, he told us, reciting it like a well-worn phrase. Often, he was sorry to say, the police themselves were the perpetrators. I found I was more disturbed by the thought of my death going unavenged than by the thought of being murdered. In conclusion, he said, I wish you the best of luck. Most of the performers kept themselves insulated from the sprawling, impoverished metropolis around them, moving between their hotels and the arena in shuttle buses. Tourists were targeted in particular because they were perceived as wealthy, which, relative to most people in Mexico City, we were. To beggars and street thieves, even the roustabouts must have looked like Princess Diana. The first day Annie and I ventured into a city market, we had to run a gauntlet of merchants and vendors stepping into our path, each grinning and saying, "Something more, señor? Something more, señor?" A tiny woman pulled at Annie's sleeve, begging for money to buy a tortilla with a hand to her stomach, her mouth open and twisted with weeping. A shoeshine boy chased me down the street, shining one of my shoes against my will, while I politely tried to flee. 5 centuries ago, this was one of the most beautiful cities on earth, an island of pyramidal temples and palaces, botanical gardens, aquariums, and canals at the center of a vast, shallow lake that mirrored the sky, linked to the mainland by long causeways and aqueducts, all raised by the armies of Cortes. Annie and I toured the cathedral built atop the ruins of the Aztec temple, where we stood before the Altar of Forgiveness, something of a euphemism had emerged, where heretics were brought to repent before being absolved and then set on fire. We also checked out the Palace of the Inquisition, which now houses a medical museum, where a cadaver lay under a glass case like a flayed sleeping beauty, arteries dyed with bright pink gunk, stomach deflated, a flap of skin discreetly folded over the genitals, a few black curls of hair glistening underneath.
"Looks like chicken,"
Annie confirmed.
She was right. The exposed fat, the adipose tissue, looked like a half-eaten drumstick left in the fridge to get cold and glutinous overnight.
There was also a disembodied head displayed in a glass cube, half of which had been dissected, with little portholes cut into the skull through which you could view the brain. The other half of the face, left intact, looked like a guy you might see across from you on the bus. He did not look happy. Back at the hotel room, I admitted that the cadavers had freaked me out.
"I detached myself from it," said Annie. "I only freaked out a little when I imagined having to eat it."
I just looked at her. "Like in Alive," she clarified. Annie loved survival stories in which people have to resort to cannibalism. After our first day out in Mexico City, our lips tasted grimy, and we both had acrid postnasal drip. We showered and brushed our teeth and ordered a bucket of Coronas on ice from room service. This would become our nightly ritual. Almost 20 years later, I still remember the phrase, un balde con hielo. That night, while we were drinking beers watching cable, Annie told me, "This morning I saw what you would look like when you're old. Kind of gray and jowly."
"Give me a break," I started. "I hadn't shaved yet. I wasn't..."
"No, no, it was good," she said. "It made me believe for the first time that maybe you would live." The sights of Mexico City have gotten jumbled together in my memory with scenes backstage at the circus, like the contents of a suitcase disheveled in transit, police standing around in Kevlar vests idly holding automatic weapons, acrobats muscled like superheroes painted solid gold, teenage boys reading porn comics next to old ladies on the bus, a wardrobe pit crew quickly repairing a rip in a dancer's stocking, bullet holes in the concrete over Trotsky's bed, ancient basalt blood basins, someone hosing out the hippo's open mouth, a dozen little chickens on a spit, midgets pushing a baby carriage, a begging child shaking a single maraca in a monotonous, unmusical rhythm, her face blank with rage. Somewhere in the arena, an elephant trumpeted, and for an instant, everyone froze. As we watched the circus rehearse from high up in the arena's stands, Annie provided indispensable dishy backstage commentary. "Remember I told you how the one unicycle basketball team captain stabbed the other last year?" she'd say. "That's the one who got stabbed. There's the 40-year-old woman my 18-year-old student is marrying, second from the left. They all think it's just to get into the family act. Oh, and that's the guy who had the little, domestic violence problem I told you about." During the Star Clowns act, he would force volunteers from the audience to wear tutus and perform a ballet routine. One elegant matron delighted the crowd by raising an outstretched leg to the bar with effortless aplomb. Clown gave her a well, well, well look, hands on his hips. Annie told me she was a ringer, actually the clown's own mother and a dancer with the circus from way back. Annie even knew the dirt on all the animals. She was caustic on the subject of animals who died. During the first day at school skit, when the trainer called attendance and the baby elephants dutifully raised their trunks, Annie hissed, "Where's Kenny? Is Kenny out sick today?" As I watched a troop of baboons in brightly colored diapers doing flips on the hippo's back, she leaned over and whispered, "Those monkeys have hideous, hideous asses." After Annie started teaching, I spent a lot of my days with her best friend in the circus, Lou. Lou had actually attended the circus's famous clown college, which he described as the greatest experience of his life. 10 weeks of classes in pie throwing, water spitting, how to run in long floppy shoes. His instructor sounded like some sort of clown Roshi. He was heavily into what Lou calls the heart of clowning, not just routines and technique. "If you're gonna be a clown," he'd tell his students, "you've gotta have a heart as big as Alaska. Clowning is snow on Christmas morning. It's an all-day sucker." He and I visited the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe together, where we rode a little conveyor belt past the miraculous image of the Virgin. Lou, a believer, admitted he had hoped it would look less like a painting. Lou's secret ambition was to resurrect the Globe of Death, a spherical cage in which two motorcyclists would ride around and around, their orbits gradually spiraling sideways and then upside down, the two of them zooming around the sphere's meridians in perfect synchronization, all somehow without crashing into each other. I remembered it well from my own childhood trips to the circus. The old globe was still in storage somewhere, like Excalibur in its stone, waiting for someone worthy to summon forth the balls to get in there again. I couldn't understand how you'd even practice this act without getting killed. Lou seemed confident that you just have to aim the bike straight ahead, get it up to speed, and let centrifugal force take care of the rest. He figured each rider would get the timing down independently, and then you'd go in there together and sort of work things out between the two of you. Annie told me Lou had never ridden a motorcycle. Annie was jealous that I got to spend my days going on field trips with her friend while she was stuck in the classroom all day. "Lou is coming between us, Annie," I told her. "Lou must die." Her eyes lit up with an evil hope. "He is the one who will die in Mexico City," she said. "It's the only way we can save ourselves." "Sacrifice!" she cried gleefully. "Sacrifice! Sacrifice!" we both began chanting, bouncing up and down on the bed. "Lou must die! Lou must die!" It was wrong of us to offer Lou as a sacrifice. Lou was a good guy. It was also probably foolhardy of us to invoke the old local gods in jest. I'd seen the goddess of death, Coatlicue, at the National Museum of Anthropology, wearing a tasteful necklace of human hands and hearts with a skull pendant and a mid-length skirt made of snakes, snakes also spurting from the decapitated stump of her neck, which was an Aztec artistic invention for blood, two of them curled face to face to resemble a single grinning, fanged, and fork-tongued serpent, she was, to all appearances, not one to be summoned on a false alarm. And the circus was no place to risk jinxing anyone. There had recently been several serious injuries on the show. I'd seen a girl who had to walk around with both arms in casts, propped up with sticks, raised over her head in what looked like triumph at all times. A performer in the other unit of the circus had been badly burned during a fire act. "How's that guy doing?" I asked Annie. "Not good," she said. And last month, a woman working without a net had fallen 40 feet from a trapeze at the DC Armory. This wasn't supposed to be possible, but somehow the cable attached to her harness had broken. She landed on her face. She was still on crutches, and one of her eyes was completely bloodshot. Lou had griped about the low attendance at shows in Mexico City. Performers were up there, their lungs laboring in the filthy high-altitude air, risking their lives every night for what? A couple of hundred spectators? The circus doesn't have a doctor, Annie told me, or even EMTs. If someone gets hurt, they just call 911 and wait like the rest of us. But there is a performance protocol in the event of an accident. There's one piece of music the orchestra plays when the trapeze artists make the triple somersault, and another to play if they don't. If there's a fall, the band whips up a jaunty, up-tempo, nothing-to-see-here number, and the entire complement of clowns charges out in full force, deploying maximum antics to distract the audience. "The show must go on," Annie said grimly. After almost a month in Mexico City, my nerves had begun to go. It seemed as if not one second passed without the sound of a car horn playing La Cucaracha, Dixie, or the theme from The Godfather. Annie told me I made this same observation every day. "Just tune it out, man," she snapped. The cry of the chiclet hawkers on the metro, ending with a sustained moan, "Peso!" started to sound inhuman and droning as a car alarm. The air always smelled like exhaust fumes and piss. I'd get winded after going up one flight of stairs. Phase one of the city's pollution control plan had been in effect for the last 5 days, a new record, and power plants had reduced their output to 60% so that the hotel's lights kept flickering. The Palazzo, the arena where the circus performed, was usually a dully gleaming bronze button on the horizon, but now it was barely visible through the dirty brown haze. It wasn't until 2 weeks into our stay that I discovered our room had a view of the mountains. I finally got the inevitable diarrhea after eating pancita, a soup made with tripe. Annie had watched in horror as I ate it, begging me to stop. "Abunda material fecal en comida de callejera," a recent headline had read. Annie translated comida de callejera as street food. I didn't need help with the rest. "Yankee matado," another tabloid headline, accompanied by a photo of a feckless American goofball like myself. Matado turned out to mean not just killed, but to connote something more like slaughtered. On the metro, I interrupted Annie in the middle of an extended daydream about being held up at gunpoint and having to explain to her assailant in broken Spanish why she had no valuables on her person. She'd already worked out in her head rough phrases for, "at pyramids yesterday, so no more film, no camera." I thought it sounded like a more complicated explanation than a mugger would sit still for. "No, no," she said. "In the fantasy, he was really nice about it. He was trying to understand me." We'd both become superstitious as soldiers nearing the end of their tour. Annie's latest blood tests had come back looking suspiciously normal, her antibodies at 0%. Did lupus go into remission? Was it possible she'd been misdiagnosed? Annie refused to call her doctor. "I don't want to find out I don't have it while we're down here," she reasoned, "because then I will be killed." We got into a debate over what seemed like the legitimate statistical question of whether talking incessantly about our robbery, kidnapping, murder increased or decreased its probability of occurring. Whenever one of us spotted an eyelash on the other's cheek, we'd always dab it off and hold it up on a fingertip to wish on and blow away. Once, after Annie had made her wish, I said, "So at least we're safe for another day." "Well," she said, "I am." At a circus party at Mexico City's Planet Hollywood, where showgirls were hitting the dance floor, midgets were shooting pool, and roustabouts were getting into shoving matches, Annie and I got drunk on tequila and confessed our deepest fears to each other, which turned out to be identical. That we would be abducted and Annie raped while I was forced to watch. "Sex crimes increase" had been another recent headline. "I fear that my failure to act heroically will come between us forever," I said. "You will always blame me and think of me as a coward. It'll destroy our friendship." "I know," she cried. "I imagine the same thing, you not being able to do anything and being ashamed and guilty about it. And I feel bad. In the fantasy, as I'm being raped, I feel bad for you." "That's nice," I said, made sentimental by tequila. "So, look," I continued, "if you are raped while I'm forced to watch, is it going to put a huge damper on our relationship?" "It'll put a big damper on my life." "Right, right, of course," I said. "Well, mine too. I mean, obviously not as much of one." "Unless you're next in line," she said, with a certain gleam in her eye. I stared at her. "You'd like that, wouldn't you?" I said. It titillates you." She cackled delightedly, wriggling and stamping her feet. Annie loved the word titillate. On one of our last nights in Mexico City, Annie had one of her panic attacks about mortality. We'd been watching some science show on TV about the scale of the universe, infinity and eternity, which always gave her the horrors. Like an idiot, I tried to talk her through it and reason with her until she pulled the blankets over her head and screamed at me to stop. We turned instead to the more soothing Anaconda, which had been on heavy rotation on cable all month. We tried to make things more interesting by placing wagers on the order in which the characters would die. Owen Wilson went first, to no one's surprise. We saw his agonized face bulging in bas-relief from the snake's belly during a swim-by. Annie had the pompous scientist down to die next, but then John Voight strangled Owen Wilson's girlfriend with his legs. He tried to kill Jennifer Lopez, too, but was stabbed with a tranquilizer dart by Eric Stoltz, shockingly revived from his wasp sting-induced coma, per Annie's prediction, putting her back in the lead. During a lull in the carnage, Annie asked me, "So, if our trip to Mexico City were a movie, which of us would die, and when?"
"Depends what genre it is," I said.
I hoped it would not prove to be a film like Anaconda, in which the characters' deaths were a foregone conclusion and the only fun was in seeing who would be next. If it was a noir, I knew I was doomed to die alone, the patsy in this conniving dame's frame-up.
"Maybe it's a screwball comedy," Annie said hopefully.
Annie did resemble the quirky, scheming heroines of the 30s more than anyone else I knew. And in a comedy, no one would die, except maybe some crotchety aunt who'd leave us millions, and we'd end up bickering happily ever after. At last, John Voight was swallowed whole, in a point-of-view shot from inside the snake's pulsing gullet. What's obvious in retrospect, although we would have denied it at the time, is how much fun we were having imagining our own gruesome murders, spooking and riling ourselves up like kids on a sleepover. This is essentially the circus's business, turning all the old primal terrors, being devoured by predators, falling while swinging from one branch to another, being chased by leering men with bottles of seltzer, into little pantomimes of near-death and escape to thrill and, yes, titillate us. Professionals literally risk their lives to provide us this sensation. These acts wouldn't be exciting without the real possibility of failure, injury, or death. It's a family-friendly form of human sacrifice. Instead of the Hill of the Star or Altar of Forgiveness, the Globe of Death.
Lou must die.
Of course, nobody really wants to see anyone killed at the circus. Jesus, it would traumatize the freaking kids for life. But if you really had no interest in seeing anyone hurt, you could always go to a movie or the zoo. What you want is to see someone nearly get killed. The circus's real promise, the one it whispers as it tucks you in sick on cotton candy, is not this time. The tamer sticks his head in the lion's maw and withdraws it, grinning. The acrobats bound unhurt off the net, arms raised in triumph. An old lady lifts a surprisingly taut, supple leg to the bar, defying age, a fantasy of athletic grace. Even John Voight's not really dead. Holy shit! The titular snake unexpectedly vomited him back onto the deck of the boat, coated with sputum but alive and gasping for air. It was still anybody's game. I flew home unkilled from Mexico City with two carry-on items, a black velvet painting of the devil on the toilet, and a single pork rind the size of an open umbrella, both of which Annie had cajoled me into buying. After she'd safely returned to the U.S., she sent me another souvenir, a papier-mâché figure she'd made, inspired by the alebrijes we'd seen in Mexico, a little girl with black-and-white striped Pippi Longstocking limbs, a polka-dot jumper, curly pink-ribbon pigtails, and a skull for a face. It was not only a Hello Kitty memento mori, but a sort of self-portrait. But in another surprise twist, a ta-da reprieve, the snake spat Annie out again, too. About a month after our trip to Mexico, she was unexpectedly given a clean bill of health. Yeah, that's right. Guess what? No more lupus. It wasn't in remission. It was just gone. Her doctor shrugged and said that in about 5% of cases, the disease, quote, just burns itself out. It's also possible she was misdiagnosed. Her odd constellation of symptoms could have been caused by fifth disease, so-called because it's the fifth and least well-known of the infectious childhood rashes. School teachers are exposed to a lot of germs. Annie gets a little touchy when you bring up the lupus scare now and jealously defends her right to continue fretting about her health. One day, she reminds us, it won't be a false alarm. She didn't return anyone's $50. I lost my wedding ring in a pyramid of grapefruit at a grocery store a few months after I flew home. Another item on Annie's short list of things for which she will never forgive me. Annie married the juggler, the one she'd run away from to join the circus. They now live in the same cabin where I once photographed her, illicitly sitting thumbs up in vindictive triumph. Not least among his virtues, she explained, was, he puts up with me. Watching her walk down the aisle to the theme song from Star Trek Enterprise, her ex-fiancé Zach, standing next to me, wept. In an entirely uncharacteristic burst of emotion, he admitted, I always thought I'd end up with Annie. I had never thought any such thing. And yet, looking at the wedding photos, I have to admit, I look kind of teary-eyed, too. 20 years after the great Mexico City circus train caper, the greatest show on earth announced that it would be closing after 146 years. Feld Entertainment, which owns the circus, claimed that attendance had dropped after animal rights activists forced them to eliminate elephants from the show. Annie, now a fervid animal rights activist herself, was unmoved. "They're behind the times anyway," she said. It's true the circus was an atavism, a relic of the 19th century surviving improbably into the 21st, like faith healers still working their tent revival miracles on satellite. The trapeze and the high wire must seem lame and anachronistic to kids jaded to slow-motion, zero-G CGI martial arts. Early movies captured real acts. Douglas Fairbanks scrambling up the drawbridge, the house falling down around Buster, Fred and Ginger doing a once-in-eternity dance in a single take. Most action scenes in American movies are now effectively very expensive cartoons, but the circus was still low rent and real. Muscle and sweat, sawdust and dung, and the chance of blood in the air. I remember, on my last day in Mexico City, watching the show one last time. When the circus began, they'd bring on everything at once in a motley spangled parade like a Roman triumph, a total sensory onslaught designed to blow the minds of five-year-olds. Clowns, acrobats, dancing girls, giant puppets, a whole basketball team on unicycles, camels and zebras, elephants walking single file with tails twined in trunks, the animal tamer in a chariot flanked by tigers. It was the first time I'd given in and watched the circus with uncritical kid-like interest. It gave me chills when the tamer cracked his whip and a team of dappled whites reared up in unison, plumed and rampant. Even the tightrope act seemed more suspenseful than usual. Unlike Annie, I do have a fear of heights, and my stomach clenched with sympathetic terror as I watched the act's climax, a seven-person human pyramid crossing the high wire. I realized I hadn't been breathing only once they'd made it safely to the other side. You could hear the gust of cathartic exhales all around the arena, then the fanfare and applause. It looked pretty scary there for a while, but see, everyone's fine. Everybody knows, at least in theory, how to make it to the other side. You just keep placing one foot in front of the other, don't look down, and keep smiling, no matter what. The show, as they say, must go on. These fantasies of untimely violent death, not just the circus, but slasher films, zombie apocalypse, and suicided idols, appeal mostly to children and adolescents. One's own perfectly timely natural death of unglamorous cancer or unattractive old age is a lot less fun to contemplate. So far, despite our decades of histrionic dread, Annie and I have both escaped serious illness, injury, or arguably any real problems at all. Except, of course, for time. Annie's seriously contemplating cosmetic surgery to address the issue of her incipient wattle. I've begun to fear that her vision of my jowls may prove prophetic. Annie's mother died of a stroke a few years ago. Mine has Parkinson's. At a little past the actuarial halfway point, we're both starting to suspect that life may not have much left in the way of pleasant surprises in store for us. Annie's lately been having panic attacks and been prescribed Klonopin, Zoloft, and a beta blocker, and has started cognitive behavioral therapy for death anxiety. The last time we talked, she was having trouble swallowing. She was pretty sure it was cancer. Everybody's got to have something. Sometime last winter, in a dark existential hour, I remembered Annie's old emergency antidote to her own late-night dread and decided, fine, I'll try it. The clip that did it for me was the famous last number from Follow the Fleet, Let's Face the Music and Dance. Fred Astaire, busted at the gaming tables on some shipboard casino, deserted by the girls who fawned over him when he was a winner, wanders disconsolately out onto some fantastic gleaming Art Deco set, where he takes out a little silver gun and holds it dramatically to his temple. But then he sees Ginger Rogers, also despondent, slinking out to the rail to throw herself over the side. He stops her and shows her his gun, pantomiming that he was just about to do something foolish himself. She makes a grab for it, but he frowns at her and tosses it over the side. And then he coaxes her to dance. It looks as if he's saving her. But really, she's the one who saved him. Annie and I still ride the train together. Because of her flying phobia, Annie's racked up so many rail miles on Amtrak that she gets a free sleeper car cross country once a year, and often lets me hop the train with her. We like to take the Empire Builder from Seattle to Chicago, hanging out in the observation lounge, watching Glacier National Park and the Great Plains go by, with a supply of New York Times crosswords and Percocet at hand. What we love most about the train is sort of the same thing we like about painkillers, the cozy in-betweenness of it, being suspended between destinations, temporarily exempt from the relentless press of time. The demographics on a transcontinental train skew so old that even in our late 40s, we get to be the glamorous young couple on board, like newlyweds on honeymoon. Human beings never were more lovely, more perfect in motion. Kind of love. Note to Mom. Please skip this track. Few are lured to the cartooning profession by the promise of its groupie action. It'd be like going into poetry for the money. Most fans of my own strip seem to be punks or Satanists or bearded conspiracy theorists who brewed their own beer. So when a 24-year-old model contacted me with a friendly, unabashed sexual proposition, it seemed likely to turn out to be either a hoax perpetrated by a basement full of snickering teens or an FBI sting operation based on a spookily astute psych profile. Her online photos made her look like a police sketch of my own anima, a tall, leggy, raucous, loudmouthed girl wearing an eye patch and a pirate hat, hoisting a bottle of whiskey high, her limbs sloppily asplay to expose armpit and pubic hair dyed scarlet. The photos appeared to have been taken at some sort of San Franciscan freak parade. A mock-up of a pirate ship was visible. Other photos showed her nude body painted silver and blue with vines twining up her torso. In close-ups, you could see a silver spiderweb of fine chains connecting three facial piercings at nostril, eyebrow, and earlobe. Her professional name was Electra Bold, but her real name, she told me, was Zoe. Zoe wasn't her real name either. It was her middle name, which I learned only when I overheard her mother call her Meredith. By then I understood that having penetrated only one name out from her real one was an impressive index of intimacy. She described herself as a performance artist, fetish model, and pleasure activist. She had grown up in Baltimore, where my cartoon ran in the local alternative weekly, which she said had helped her get through her depressed adolescence. Clinically depressed, as in institutionalization and electroconvulsive therapy. She told me a whole long story about her friend Ray and her deciding, during a drunken blizzard in Baltimore, to phone me up and offer to buy me a beer and give me a blowjob, respectively. The plan had guttered away with the hangover thaw, and she lived on the West Coast now, but she was writing to tell me she'd be back in Baltimore for a week at Christmas and that her part of the offer, at least, was still valid. I was much younger then. We met through a now-extinct social network. And my inner 14-year-old, still incredulous that girls would consent to get into bed with him at all, was very much alive and exerting considerable influence. Most of my serious girlfriends to date had been what Zoe would call my type A. Smart, pretty, sane, moral girls with glasses who tended to work for nonprofits or write, not body dominatrices. I was tortured by the suspicion that I was missing out on a whole world of evil sexual adventure. Threesomes and sex clubs and rampant, unrepentant sluttiness. This out-of-the-ether invitation seemed like my entree into that world, like a found invitation to an orgy. And after all, this is the whole reason you become an artist in the first place, besides not wanting to get a job, in hopes that it will make girls, or your preferred gender, want to have sex with you. Dude, my friend Harold advised me, after conducting some internet researches of his own, I think she might be a whore. No, I said. She's just one of those free-spirited, West Coast, sex-positive types. I'm pretty sure she's not literally a prostitute. She was literally a prostitute. Actually, Zoe preferred the term whore. She confided this to me a few weeks before we were to meet, with a nervousness that seemed touchingly out of character for her no-prisoner's image. She was afraid it might deter me from following through on our date. It did give me pause. I'd never patronized a prostitute, less because of any moral qualms than a self-imposed stigma. I didn't want to think of myself as the kind of guy who patronized prostitutes. I also couldn't imagine suspending disbelief enough to convince myself that someone was attracted to me who was being paid to act like it. Although I did this easily enough with barmaids, waitresses, baristas, clerks, massage therapists, and psychiatrists. But I wasn't a customer, I reasoned. Zoe really did like me, even if the me she liked was as much a professional persona as her own. The day we met, She came to the door of her mother's house wearing only a towel, still warm and pink from the shower. Zoe had been running 40 minutes late, pretty much since birth. The chains on her face made me a little ill at ease.